we're talking about the problematic air quality along the Lake Michigan shoreline and the EPA's expanded smog regulations. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Smog or ozone pollution typically stems from factory smokestacks. It comes from power plants, vehicle emissions. According to the DNR's Air Quality Trends Report published last fall, 95% of Wisconsinites live in areas meeting all federal air quality standards. But historically, the Lake Michigan shoreline is an area with elevated ozone concentrations. Do you live along Lake Michigan? Have you noticed changes in your air quality? It's 800-642-1234. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She's been covering the developments in federal smog regulations. Danny, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So before we get into the back and forth with the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, can you explain what smog is and where it comes from?
Yeah, sure. So smog or ozone pollution typically happens in the summer months because that's when you have these air pollutants like nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds. And those pollutants interact with heat and sunlight to form smog. And these are pollutants that generally come from things like power plant or vehicle emissions.
And how does this interact with Lake Michigan and a body of water?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, so, you know, we see the airflow of Lake Michigan too, where a lot of this pollution in the air is carried out over the lake. And so part of that is because we're seeing it come from a lot of different places. And so I think the meteorology is just one aspect that helps set the stage sometimes for these pollutants or this ozone pollution to form at the ground level along the lakeshore of Lake Michigan.
So what do the federal smog regulations currently say about emissions?
Sure. So the Clean Air Act requires the Environmental Protection Agency to designate areas across the country that aren't meeting these federal air quality standards for ozone. And so these are places that are called non-attainment areas because they're not meeting those standards. And there's a lot that's changed with that in the last decade or so. But most recently, the EPA expanded that list of non-attainment areas or places that aren't meeting those smog regulations here in Wisconsin. And I can get into more of why that happened. But basically, you know, we've got a larger list of areas along the lakeshore of Lake Michigan that aren't meeting those standards for smog or ozone pollution.
Yeah, you know, what regions in the state are not meeting these current federal smog regulations? What are the problematic areas?
So in Wisconsin, that list of areas, well, prior to this change that weren't meeting the federal smog regulations were lakeshore areas of Kenosha, Door, Manitowoc, Sheboygan, and northern Milwaukee and northern Ozaukee counties. And again, that was different from a broader list of areas that the EPA had originally proposed when they came out with a proposal in 2017. And that list had actually included all of Waukesha, Washington, and Racine counties as well. And those were excluded or kept out of the agency's final designations that they arrived at several years ago now in 2018. But last month, the EPA restored most of those original designations that they had made in Wisconsin. So now all of Milwaukee and Ozaukee counties will need to meet those tighter emissions limits, but only parts of Washington, Waukesha, and Racine counties, and a larger part of Sheboygan, Manitowoc, Door, and Kenosha counties will also face these stricter ozone regulations.
Yeah, I mean, during the Trump era, business groups were pushing hard in Congress and the courts to kind of roll back the smog standard that had been adopted during the Obama era. What has the sentiment been from the EPA under the Biden administration?
Under the Biden administration, well, with this change that was made, which was recently made this spring, they have basically brought it in line with the EPA's original proposal under the Trump administration. So basically, they're kind of reverting it back to the way the agency had originally envisioned these air quality designations along Lake Michigan. And that stemmed more in part from some legal challenges as opposed to any rulemaking that was pursued by the Trump administration.
We're talking with WPR reporter Danielle Kading discussing smog regulations and the EPA cracking down on areas in Wisconsin not currently meeting federal standards. Do you live near Lake Michigan? Have you noticed changes in your air quality? What do you want to know about air quality there? Do you live in the southwestern part of the state? What have you noticed about your breathing and your air? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. You know, when you say Door County, it's like this is a small community, you know, relatively little traffic, although in the summer that certainly changes, but you don't think of it having big polluters. How does that happen where you have non-attainment standards or non-attainment in these smaller communities along the shoreline?
Right. Well, this is something that business groups and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources have actually argued under former Republican Governor Scott Walker, which is that a lot of this pollution around the Milwaukee area and along Lake Michigan comes from Illinois and Indiana. And so they kind of detailed their position to the EPA back in 2018 and pointed to data that they had that showed that the Chicago area was responsible for the vast majority of these emissions and that, you know, basically it's being carried up through wind and other factors along the lakeshore. So while there might not be a ton of big industries or emitters in that area, pollution doesn't have any boundaries.
Right, yeah. You know, yeah, there's this one headline in the Chicago Tribune from 2017, smog follows Chicagoans on vacation to Wisconsin. And, you know, I mean, it makes that point, right? That this air pollution can go across boundaries. It doesn't matter. Do you see any ability of states working together here to fix the air quality?
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, because these changes that were recently made related to the areas that have new designations now for their air quality or that they have to meet these ozone standards, you know, that also applies to other states too, like Illinois. And in the Illinois non-attainment area, like the Chicago, Kenosha County, that sort of region, they'll also have to, you know, come in line with these new standards. And so, and I shouldn't say that they're new, you know, it was something that was proposed in 2015 by the Obama administration. Essentially, they created a stricter standard for ozone pollution. And so now with this recent court ruling and this recent decision by the EPA, they'll have to come in line with those standards.
What about like Foxconn in Mount Pleasant, a plant facing these tougher smog regulations? Will there be a reexamination? What might happen there?
You know, the state's going to have to figure out how to best comply with these ozone standards. I really don't have a good idea of how the redesignation could impact any particular project, but certainly that was something that was brought up several years ago when they were looking at this. You know, I think Governor Walker's administration was lobbying hard to get that project built at the time, and they were certainly in the ear of the EPA when they were making this designation. And so, you know, there was a lot of criticism at that time that maybe this played a role in why Racine County was removed from the final list of areas that were not meeting these ozone standards. And so now it's been changed, and we'll see what happens as far as the DNR implementing these regulations and what that means for industries along the lakeshore.
We're talking with WPR reporter Danny Kading about new federal smog regulations in Wisconsin, how counties along the shoreline will approach them. The EPA's air standards are growing stricter with ozone limits last tightened in 2015, as we've been talking about. Do you live near an industrial plant, or are you concerned about air quality in your area? Join in. The conversation is at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Danielle Kading here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing air quality along the lakeshore areas of southeastern Wisconsin and expanding standards by the EPA. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this year, the American Lung Association, it gave failing grades to six counties along Lake Michigan over smog pollution as part of its national report card on state air quality. Are you in business and industry that has added pollution controls? What have you done? Do you have asthma? How has your summer been with air quality? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. WPR reporter Danielle Kading is here. We're discussing the latest developments concerning federal smog regulations. So, Danny, what does this mean for coal plants and emissions with energy and coal?
Okay, for coal plants and coal. Well, you know, it's kind of an interesting question what it might mean. I mean, because when you make these changes to the standards, it could mean costly pollution controls for industries if their emissions are going beyond what is acceptable. But with power plants, you know, we have seen them spend hundreds of millions of dollars in recent years to comply with emissions. But what's interesting now is that a lot of these plants are being retired or coming offline soon. So I think, you know, we're going to see some improvement in air quality with these plants like the Edgewater coal plant in Sheboygan coming offline. Whether or not they'll have to install any emissions controls, I don't think that's likely from what we're hearing from the Wisconsin DNR. It sounds like, you know, only five or fewer projects would be impacted by these changes, because at least among major sources of emissions, because it sounds like right now they're meeting the standards for ozone, but it could impact future development. And so I think it remains to be seen, you know, like if we see air quality continue to deteriorate in some of these areas, then these things could be changed in the future.
It could impact
Neosho County.
Yeah, it could impact industry expansion, for instance.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce is pretty concerned about. You know, they've called areas that have been designated non-attainment or where these ozone standards aren't being met as no-grow zones. So they've been really concerned about what the impacts of these standards might mean for industry along the lakefront.
Let's bring in Pamela now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Pamela. How is your air?
Well, the air here is, I've come downtown Milwaukee and we're near a lot of heavy industry, so it's not really great. And we're by a freeway. So, but I was calling about pollution from airports, and I know the Milwaukee airport has quite a bit of traffic. Chicago airports have a lot of traffic. And also there's a big argument going over stationing F-35 aircraft in Truex Field in Madison, because that will emit almost 50,000 tons of carbon dioxide at a cost of $44,000 per flight hour. So we'd like to see some of this military and civilian aircraft regulated. Thank you.
Pamela, thank you for that. And so, Danny, you know, Pamela, very concerned there about flying and the pollution there.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if there's a direct correlation between emissions from airplanes and ozone pollution. Maybe there is with air pollution in general. I mean, certainly, like what we see with ozone is that it can damage lung tissue, it can worsen asthma, It can increase the risk of lung cancer, and it can make people more susceptible to respiratory infections. And that has been a huge concern during the COVID-19 pandemic because, you know, we've seen the virus has claimed a lot of lives, and it's also led to a lot of long-lasting lung damage for a lot of people. And so, you know, just speaking more generally about air pollution, researchers at Harvard University have actually linked like this fine soot pollution to higher death rates from the virus, especially for low-income minority communities that live near these power plants or industries along the lakefront. So Pamela's concern about air pollution, certainly valid. And, you know, there are more than just, you know, nitrogen oxides or volatile organic compounds in our air. And so it's important to be thinking about the cumulative
impact. The whole picture. Yeah, yeah, right. Looking at the litigation, Clean Wisconsin filing a lawsuit against the EPA in 2018 regarding smog regulations. What have you seen out of the courts and litigation here?
Yeah, well, so a number of environmental groups and local governments filed some legal challenges after the EPA came out with their final list of areas that weren't meeting these federal ozone standards. They launched these legal challenges in 2018. And that prompted a lengthy review in the courts, which ended up with a ruling in the DC Circuit Court out east last summer. And so the EPA had to go back and review their air quality designations for ozone in these areas that these lawsuits targeted. And so as part of that, that's what's prompting these changes now, where they've expanded this list of areas that would be subject to these ozone standards.
Yeah. We're talking with WPR reporter Danielle Kading, discussing new expanded EPA smog regulations, what it means for Wisconsin and what it means for your community. You can join in on air quality, air pollution, 800-642-1234. Danny, is there any talk about whether the air quality rules should be adjusted for cities where the topography and the weather may be preventing smog from dissipating?
Well, I think that the DNR has certainly, you know, addressed this issue related to the geography, you know, where is this pollution coming from, and can we reduce it at the source? And, you know, environmental groups have argued that even if an area is not the like responsible for the vast majority of these emissions, they still contribute to it. And if you can reduce it and do your part, then why wouldn't you, is kind of their perspective on this. You know, some staff at the DNR, I think they would argue that, you know, you mentioned before, like the failing grades that were given to these counties along Lake Michigan as far as their air quality. And, you know, the DNR has argued that some of the models or the data that's used by the American Lung Association in putting out these reports is not how the EPA measures whether they're meeting these health objectives. They're based on this air quality monitoring data that they've gathered over time. And the DNR has said, well, it's not just the monitoring data that is used in coming up with these air quality designations. It's also the emissions data and the meteorology and the geography and the jurisdictional boundaries. And so, you know, there's some disagreement between what we should be measuring, I think, as far as determining the air quality in these areas.
Well, let's bring in Penny, who lives in Sheboygan. Hi, Penny. Go ahead.
Good morning. My question is, if these industries, which they've said they are, spending a substantial amount of money on lawsuits, wouldn't they just be better off investing in air quality controls? Because ultimately, you're going to have to do it anyways. And the longer you wait, the more costly it's going to be. Just invest in air quality controls. Why is there even a question about that?
And Penny, thank you. Very quickly, how do you feel about your air where you are in Sheboygan?
Well, I happen to live in the part of town that has a substantial amount of trees, which is another thing that helps remove pollution from the air. Mm. So my personal air quality, I would say, is very good. But depending upon what part of town you're in, it certainly isn't.
Penny,
and having lived there for a long time, I've definitely seen a decline.
Penny, thank you. Danny, very quickly, final thoughts.
Well, you know, she said that she's seen a decline, and maybe that's true at a very local level. The DNR issued a report last year that said that air quality has actually been improving along Lake Michigan with ozone pollution, and it's been dropping 25% on average since 2001. So hopefully they're making improvements as they move forward in the air quality along the lakeshore.
Danny, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter in Superior. We have a link to her reporting on EPA smog regulations. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, how do you think the Biden-Putin summit went? What do you think about President Biden's role on the world stage? We'll talk about it. 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. This year marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, here's Wisconsin Life host Maureen McCollum sharing a story for Father's Day. It's WPR producer Brad Kohlberg's pick for his favorite Wisconsin Life story.
Learning to ride a bike can be a milestone in a person's life. Lately, WPR producer and local dad, Brad Kohlberg, has been thinking about when he first learned how to ride a bike, teaching his daughter to ride, and what biking has meant to his family over the years, all because of a song he recently heard.
There's a band that I've followed on and off since college called Pedro the Lion, and they released a new song a while back called Yellow Bike. It's about getting your first bike and how the world opens up when you learn to ride it. It was a blast of nostalgia for me. It made me think of my first bike, my dad helping me learn to ride, me helping my daughter, and how important bike rides have been for my family over the years.
On a desert Christmas morning, 1981.
I got my first bike on my 6th birthday, a red Murray brand with chrome handlebars and chunky black tires. A bike for popping wheelies and doing sweet jumps. I loved it.
My heart thumping in my chest. Though I tried, I couldn't ride one yet.
The other neighborhood kids rode their bikes around in a little pack all day, and I really wanted to join, but I was embarrassed of the training wheels. So I begged, and my dad took them off, and I ran around pushing my bike beside me, trying to keep up with them. I couldn't. During practice sessions, my dad ran alongside me, gave me a nudge and let go of the seat. I'd coast, try to pedal, crash into the neighbor's mailbox. I even ran over my little brother one day when he wandered into my path and I couldn't steer around him. Sorry, Dave.
But I remember what it was like to stride my yellow bike. First freedom, second life.
A friend had a bike that was smaller than mine, and my feet could easily touch the ground when I sat on it, which made it easier to coast. I'd ease down my driveway on his bike with my feet dangling to see how far I could go. One afternoon, I put my feet up and started pedaling, and I took off. I was riding. I still feel a little sad that my dad was at work when it finally happened. Sorry, Dad. But I didn't look back. The neighborhood became infinite. A motocross track, a battlefield, a movie set. All the money I made at my first job picking sweet corn went to building better bikes for bigger jumps. And I spent every summer day riding around town with my friends until I got to high school, when it became kid stuff, like overnight. My BMX gathered dust and was forgotten. Fast forward 25 years, and I was running beside my daughter in the church parking lot up the street as she learned to ride her first bike.
Okay, you ready? One, two, three. Go, go, go!
I gave her a nudge, let go of the seat, and watched her pull away from me and turn the corner out of sight. Now she's almost 14, and my old bag of tricks doesn't really work anymore. Legos, backyard baseball, trips to the playground. But she still rides around the neighborhood with me after dinner.
Dad, how long have you been videoing?
We talk a lot while we ride, and sometimes we keep the conversation going with some ice cream afterward. It's the greatest. So when I heard that Pedro the Lion song, you know what I did? I went out and got myself a new BMX bike. A bike for popping wheelies and doing sweet jumps. Because sometimes dads and kids aren't that different. And I feel like a kid when I ride it, with my daughter beside me. It's the greatest.
I trade my kingdom for someone to ride with.
Brad Kohlberg is a producer for WPR in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to President Biden on the world stage in his first international trip as president. A lot of ground to cover. And wrapping with that meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, Biden was asked several times in his press conference whether he could trust Putin.
This is not about trust. This is about self-interest and verification of self-interest. That's what it's about.
What are your takeaways from Biden's trip? He declared the U.S. is back. Are we? 800-642-1234. Bruce Gentleson is professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Bruce, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Good to be with you again.
So Biden declared that America is back at the table. What does that mean to you through your foreign policy lens?
Yeah, the parts of the trip kind of fit together. You know, the first were the meetings with allies, the G7, NATO, and the European Union. And there he's basically saying that, look, we don't agree on everything, but we're friends and allies. We do better when we work together. Let's be honest about our differences, but we mostly have commonalities. We're back to work with you. With the adversaries, with the Russians, with Putin, you know, it was very different. It was, we don't want a new Cold War with you. But we're done with what happened in the previous administration, which is somehow believing you more than we believe our own intelligence agencies. We'll find ways to work together. And we're going to be honest about our differences, and we're going to challenge you on the differences.
Yeah, you know, we heard a lot on this trip about improved relations with U.S. allies. But, you know, what were some of the sticking points? Where did you see the tension?
Interesting. You know, so one of the issues, there's always trade issues. Mm-hmm. And there's a long dispute about aircraft, Boeing and Airbus, that got worked out. But there were also other issues that they had, and they set up processes to work on those. Another issue was China. You know, I have to say, you know, I support President Biden in many ways, but I worry that we're kind of overdoing the China threat now. You know, and risking a possible new Cold War with them. And there are issues to deal with them, but you don't want to go too far. And there the allies, some of the allies said, you know, we're a little worried you Americans sometimes tend to go too far with your threats. And we want to push back on you to find a balance on those. So that was an issue that was pretty, you know, they papered it over. But there's a lot to work on there.
I wonder, I've been really eager to ask you this. Have vaccines been a testing ground for international cooperation? What has vaccine diplomacy exposed to you?
Okay, you know, you and I and our families and all your listeners, it's been, you know, an amazing year, almost year and a half now. And I think that what we're seeing is that while the United States has had some companies that have been very successful at developing vaccines, and we're taking care of our own people first, pandemics, this one and the next one, which is not if but when, won't go away unless we find ways to work together. So the allies together announced 1 billion doses for the poorer countries in the world. That's great. Number one, we got to see if we really deliver on that. And number two, it's just a drop in the bucket. The best vaccine diplomacy is everybody try to work together because you're not going to be able to travel or things come in through shipping until we all find ways to deal with this as a global problem.
I want to circle back to NATO, the NATO allies, the alliance of countries from Europe and North America. And, you know, you kind of skimmed over a lot of challenges here. There's the challenge from Russia, the cyber attacks, the more assertive China. How much of a difference is it from NATO's perspective going from the Trump era to the Biden administration era?
It's so different. You know, Trump was the first Republican and Democratic presidents have always agreed and disagreed. Trump was the first president to somehow treat NATO as a problem rather than as an asset. NATO is not the solution to all of these. It's particularly important for dealing with the Russians in Europe and on the Ukraine issue, on some of the countries that are now members of NATO that used to be part of the Soviet Union, like Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. But it's a military alliance, and some of the other issues are political, diplomatic, and economic, and we need other mechanisms and relationships to deal with those.
What does Biden want out of NATO? What does it want out of, you know, modernizing NATO?
You know, there was a big issue about, you know, who's contributing what. That continues to be an issue, and there are differences there. Trump made that the major issue, is that, you know, as if it was sort of paying your country club dues. And so NATO needs to work together primarily on the Russian threat, both on the ground and also the cyber issues. You know, President Biden said he gave Putin a list of particular parts of our society, not military things, but, you know, oil and gas pipelines.
16 areas of critical infrastructure. Yeah.
Yeah. And those are really important. And I think, you know, frankly, a president who knows what he's doing doesn't get out in public and say, here's what I demanded or threatened Putin, because it makes it less likely that you're going to be able to solve the problem. He's confident enough to say, yeah, these are the issues. And let me just tell you that we talked about them. We talked about them vigorously. And I made it clear we have assets, too. And we'll, you know, and we'll see over the next 6 months if we make progress on that. That's kind of the way you do it, rather than get out there and beat your chest and say, you know, I told him what to do. That doesn't work.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Biden has said he wants that stable, predictable relationship with Russia. But, you know, the hallmark of Putin is his, you know, unpredictability. So as Putin returns to Russia, what is his position on the U.S. now?
Well, it's interesting. Even when we've had differences, when we have common interests, we work together, right? So as soon as Biden came into office, we renewed the nuclear arms treaties. That's really our biggest issue with Russia, given that we both have the largest arsenals of nuclear weapons. Secondly, if you go back to 2015, despite everything else, we worked together on the Iran issue, right? We worked together to get Iran to agree to a deal that they were observing until Trump pulled out of it, and now we're working together to get the deal back. In Syria, we have differences, but one of the things that Biden stressed was, you know, working together to get humanitarian aid to people on the ground. And Putin's finding out that, you know, Assad, the leader in Syria, isn't a great friend to have. He's expensive. He's unreliable. So you find areas in which you can work together, even when you have differences. And then you try to manage those differences while you're doing both. It's kind of a two-track strategy.
We have Duke University public policy and political science professor, author of The Peacemakers, Bruce Gentleson, is here with analysis on President Biden's first international trip, a busy one. How do you think President Biden did at the G7 summit? What direction do you see the U.S. moving in foreign policy? What did the trip tell you about Biden's worldview? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Bruce Gentleson here on the Ideas Network. We're getting your reaction to the Biden-Putin summit on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden, in his press conference, said he made no threats to Putin, and they talked about basic, fundamental things.
Just letting him know where I stood, what I thought we could accomplish together, and what, in fact, if there were violations of American sovereignty, what we would do.
Do you think the U.S. and Russia are able to find common ground? What should the U.S. do about cyber attacks? Join in 800-642-1234. Bruce Gentleson is a public policy and political science professor at Duke, and he served in the Obama administration. State Department stays with us. Let's bring in perspective from Mike in Shell Lake. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
What are your thoughts on President Biden's first international trip?
Well, I honestly, Biden come across weak and like a bumbling fool, like he has been for everything. I mean, nothing has settled. They didn't discuss it. I think Putin honestly had to think Biden was a joke. That's about all I can say about it.
Bruce, what are your thoughts in the face-to-face meeting, Biden coming across weak to Mike?
Yeah, I disagree, Mike. I mean, I've had, you know, criticisms of President Biden on a number of issues. But when Putin said he's very professional, he's very different than your other leader, I kind of think the irony was that Putin was taking a shot at Trump, who had done a total embrace of Putin. And so, you know, Biden really showed his experience. He reminded me of George H.W. Bush, who came to the presidency with a lot of experience. And like a lot of things in life, whether it's business or anything, experience matters. And so when he said, I didn't threaten him, but he said, I told him what our interests are and what we disagree with and what we would do. You know, I think that was pretty right way to say it, that, you know, you don't want a headline saying threats, but you made it clear privately. So I think he was quite good, frankly, in carrying this out.
They agreed to begin some diplomatic conversations around cybersecurity. Is talking a first step there? What did you see?
Yeah, it is. But, you know, sometimes you just talk and it goes nowhere and there's a process that kind of goes sideways. And Biden himself said, you know, it's going to take months. Let's see where we are in 6 months. And so if you and I are talking 6 months from now and nothing, I don't expect total solution, but nothing has come out of this, then it would be fair to say that, oh, the summit was just, you know, its own version of a photo op. But they highlighted the two of the really key issues with Russia. You know, one is nuclear weapons. And second is cyber. And third, to a certain extent, was Ukraine. But really, the Europeans, since they're there, have more of a role in that than we do.
Hmm. What do you see out of nuclear and nuclear arms?
You know, ever since, you know, even going back to Richard Nixon in the 1970s during the Cold War, we realized that it was in neither country's interest to just keep building arsenals. It was expensive. It was dangerous. Some of us are old enough to live through the Cuban Missile Crisis. Pretty scary times. And so we consistently have worked on those issues. You know, Bill Clinton did, George W. Bush did, Obama did. And the fact that right away, right after January 20th, this was an area that Russians and Americans agreed to keep a treaty going, not let it expire and work on, says a lot about this notion of where we have common interests, let's work on them. And, you know, it's easy to forget nuclear weapons. They're sort of out there.
There are so many other things. Yeah. You know, Biden is among a string of presidents who've met with Putin. Putin stood there on the world stage with Biden. How important was it to engage with America again and talk about arms control?
You know, sometimes I hear, including from people on the liberal side, that it's a privilege to meet with an American president. I don't really buy that. You know, Russia's been a powerful and important country in the world for, you know, centuries before we were even a country. They don't need us to say that they're a major power. And the notion that you're meeting with the other major military power, you come to the world stage, you know, as, you know, in common ground in that way. So it wasn't a privilege. It was a necessary part of doing business.
Let's go to Marcus in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. What were your observations?
Hi. So I feel that all the leaders on the world stage in that case are remiss because we have a global crisis going on where the climate is clearly changing. We have crazy wildfires burning in five states out west. And it's only a matter of time before, like, there's going to be multiple areas on multiple different continents that are all devastated by whatever natural disasters occurring, be it superstorms or, you know, typhoons or wildfires. And we're going to need cooperation. And we're all on this spaceship called Earth, and we kind of need to keep it together because if there's no Earth, there's no need to squabble over the rest of this stuff.
Marcus, thank you. The threat of climate change rises above all.
Yeah, Marcus, I totally agree with you. I think one of the flaws in the G7 meeting was too much emphasis on China, not enough on climate. You know, there's a big meeting coming up in November in Glasgow, Scotland, of all the world countries that had signed this Paris Agreement back in 2015. And frankly, nobody's meeting their obligations, not just, you know, us. And climate change, you know, is, as they say, you know, existential. Yeah, China's a serious threat. To me, climate change and the next pandemic, this and the next pandemic are the two greatest threats. They, you know, pandemic killed a lot of the most people, more than wars have. So I agree with you. I think we can't just keep that on the side. I would have put that front and center to the G7 meeting. And then, you know, it's a priority with China and other countries, too. G7 can't solve it on its own.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Bruce Gentleson, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University, as he gives us analysis of President Biden's first international trip. Don is joining us from Merrill with reaction. Hi, Don. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I just wanted to say that I'm really happy that we have a president that's no longer pandering to nonsense. You know, what we had in Trump was a guy that he talked big, but it was all fluff. Biden comes on and he brings sensibility. He's very pragmatic, and his experience really represents the United States as a whole to the rest of the country, which is something that we desperately needed compared to the previous 4 years with Trump. Thank you.
Don, thanks. Your reaction there, Bruce.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that's why there have been Republican presidents that I've disagreed with before, you know, Reagan, George W. Bush, but never one that I truly thought was dangerous to the country and the world. And that's my view. And I think the other thing is Biden has a very good team. They're very experienced. Transparency, many are colleagues and friends of mine, but they've worked with Republicans and Democrats before. The people around Trump were all like believers in Trump. And really nothing else. And that's just dangerous for the country and for the world.
Biden and his advisors have said they want to do a better job of connecting foreign policy with domestic policy. What might that look like through your lens? How do you do that?
I think number one is the trade issue that, you know, we're trying to make sure that trade doesn't just benefit major American companies. So, for example, cracking down on tax havens, you know, you don't want companies closing factories in Wisconsin just because labor is cheaper in China. You've got to be able to have the benefits of trade and globalization for the average American all over the country. I think number two really are things like the pandemic and healthcare, and, you know, using what we've been through in the pandemic to not only deal with COVID, but also realize that we need to deliver health services in rural areas and other areas, and that is part of foreign policy because you're linking with others around the world to do so. And so to bring it home to people so that they see that it's not just something being done way out there, but it also affects their daily lives in here.
In the last few moments we have with you, what are you watching with the U.S.-Russia relationship going forward?
I'm watching follow-through. You know, do these working groups matter? Is there a possibility to make progress on issues like Syria and Ukraine that are military issues? And that also, is there a way to, you know, find a continuity to this? You know, President Biden and Putin should be in constant communication. We've agreed to send our ambassadors back to the capitals. Which people may think, oh, what does that matter? You know, all they do is go to cocktail parties. They do more than that. It's a constant communication. So let's see that we take these steps, even if they're small steps. When they come together, it can put the relationship on sounder footing, even as we continue to have differences.
Bruce, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Kate. Thank you, and thank your callers as well.
Bruce Gentleson, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Just ahead, we examine the historical origins of Juneteenth. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.